Good morning, everyone. My name is Rob Keefe with my colleague Carol Brownstein-Evans. We will be presenting our paper titled Assessing Postpartum Depression Among Low-Income Mothers, Culture, Race, and Ethnicity. I am Robert Keefe, and like everyone else, I have nothing to declare. And
I'm Carol Brownstein-Evans, and I too have nothing to disclose.
And I'm at the University of Buffalo, State University of New York. Carol is at Nazareth College. We're both faculty at our respective schools of social work. In case you did not hear us, we have nothing to declare. Okay. So our presentation today will focus on the common and unique experiences of culturally, racially, and ethnically diverse groups of mothers living with postpartum depression, primarily African American and Latina mothers. Just about all of the research, and I 98-99% of it truly is focused on white women who have access to care, who are largely heterosexually coupled, and have ongoing relationships with their health providers. So we decided to start looking at mothers of color and to begin looking at more macro level factors that may impact postpartum depression as opposed to intrapsychic factors that make up the body of the literature. So we'll also be talking a bit about assessment tools that social workers can use to assess postpartum depression that have been normed on mothers of color. Some of the points that we'll be making come from preliminary data of a qualitative study with African American and Latina mothers at urban health centers in Rochester, New York. So, postpartum depression, what is it? Well, the DSM, as well as Cox and Holden, tell us that depressive disorder without psychotic features, which presents within the first year following childbirth. We do know that it is the most common perinatal mood disorder. Others include postpartum psychosis, postpartum obsessive compulsive disorder, and postpartum anxiety disorder. Postpartum depression affects 10 to 13% of the population. The very few studies that have looked at mothers of color find the prevalence rates to be about 25%. Some have even found upwards to 52%. We'd like to point out that the criteria for other forms of depression indicate an onset within 2 weeks of the stressor. With postpartum depression, we have found that the onset of depression itself seems to present itself upwards to a good year after childbirth. So the risk factors for postpartum depression are largely, a history of depression that is, an antenatal history antenatal history of depression, a history of postpartum depression from mothers who have given birth in the past, stressful events during the past year, which may include pregnancy complications, illnesses, job loss, separation from the father of the child, or a conflicted relationship with the father, problems within primary relationships, including families of origin, a weak support system, financial problems, and having an unplanned or unwanted pregnancy. So the symptoms are the typical symptoms we see with depression. So what we've done here is we have nested those symptoms within the three domains that we see with depression, the somatic, the affective, and the cognitive. And as you can see, we realize this is a busy slide, but none of this should look at all surprising to you. It's the typical symptoms that we do see with general depression. So I'm going to turn over to Carol now to go over the next several slides.
You'll hear our voices alternate. So in contrast to that professional and clinical language that describes postpartum depression, we have the ways that the mothers begin to describe themselves. And they talk about being stressed, worried, anxious about their children and about their responsibilities as mothers, talking about being overwhelmed with their responsibilities and concerns, and saying things like, it's too much, I can't do it all. They may say they cannot sleep or they're always tired. They may be tearful, sad, crying, no joy in life. Sometimes they just want to be alone. They have no energy. They may use the word depressed. Sometimes they say they don't want to see their children. They tell their children, go away, play. And then they feel bad about that. And they can come to the sense of there are no solutions. They just want to run away from it all, but say, I can't, because who would take care of my children? We do know from the literature that that depression during pregnancy is often unrecognized, and nearly half the mothers with postpartum depression do not seek treatment. Up to 80% of the mothers who do seek treatment aren't disclosing their symptoms to their healthcare providers, so they may be turning to other sources. It may be ministers, it may be family, and then getting to counselors or mental health services. So consequently, what mothers need comes in sort of three areas. Prevention, which may mean help adhering to postnatal care plans, especially nutrition, sleep, exercise, self-care. Screening, the area of screening, early screening with well-evaluated instruments, and referrals. If their feelings and symptoms are really beginning to interfere with their functioning. We know that mothers of color, particularly poor mothers of color, will live in areas where there's limited availability of services. They may be less likely to receive needed services even once they've accessed a health care center. They may receive poorer quality and more generic forms of care. I think what Julia referenced in terms of, like, sometimes they're considered frequent flyers in terms of somatic complaints or other behavior problems. They are underrepresented in healthcare research, and so we don't always have their voices telling us what it is that works for them and how they want us as healthcare providers to respond to them. It's known that there are fewer providers of color to choose from who they may relate to in terms of discussing their life context and what they're going through, and that many of the providers who may be serving in these low-income, high-risk areas may not be sufficiently trained in culturally appropriate services. What we do know, both in terms of our practice in maternal child health, but also the preliminary data from our research, is that many times these mothers will seek the help of elders in their community, spiritual leaders, fellow church members. They talk about leaving it at the altar, giving their problems over to God. Certainly the vast majority of women that we've talked to so far are Christian. They turn to prayer to survive their challenging life situations. They do believe they must persevere through the difficult times, despite how down they might feel. They don't focus on their mental or emotional health. They focus on their daily coping and feel that they must endure and overcome in order to ensure their children's survival. They may feel depressed, exhausted, overwhelmed, and yet they maintain that daily functioning, so listening for the real strength in what they're doing. All of these feelings and behaviors may be translated into mental health symptoms according to the DSM-5, but that's not at all how the mothers see or describe themselves. So their experiences are not necessarily reflected in the current behavioral research. They face challenging roles as women and as new mothers that other research participants who are white or middle class have more access to financial and economic resources, things that those mothers may not have to face. They have life situations that are complicated by poverty, underemployment, single parenthood, lack of resources, unsafe neighborhoods, health and mental health issues that their children may be suffering from. I've been amazed in our sample so far at how many mothers are describing that they have children with some pretty serious health issues. Not just that they have a number of children to take care of, but their children have more than the usual health care issues. They're trying to juggle their jobs. Many of them are trying to get education and degrees to improve their economic situation, child care, household management, family obligations, and often doing this as single mothers or at times as single mothers. They believe that they have to be strong for their children and their families, and in the things that they have told us, we have also found in the literature that there are some perceptions of the strong black woman, the superwoman, and how she has to be strong and endure well beyond what you might think in order to be strong for her family. And then in Latina culture, Marianismo, the strong Latina woman, based on the virtues of the Virgin Mother, seem to guide some of their beliefs in terms of how to be a good mother and what life demands of them. They often describe their social context, the demands and challenges, as normal and experienced by everyone. And I again was listening to Julia's presentation thinking of how much am I struggling compared to someone else I know in my neighborhood and in my community, and therefore I'm kind of doing all right, despite how difficult it is. But these mothers are motivated and required to keep going despite the life challenges. And so the medical model of treatment of traditional mental health doesn't totally fit with how they see their situation.
When looking at opportunities for screening mothers, social workers do have ample opportunity to get in and screen mothers for postpartum depression. Carol and I are involved in a project right now where we're surveying, or about to survey, perinatal social workers nationwide to find out more about how they go about screening and diagnosing new mothers. We would like to put forward that there are ample opportunities for social workers to get in there and do that screening. The inpatient social worker is able to screen after delivery and provide the community social worker with information for supportive follow-up with the new mother. The Postpartum Depression Predictors Inventory, and we'll be going over some of these scales briefly in later slides, is an excellent tool that the social worker can use just by screening files, patient files, to really come up with ideas of which mothers might be at risk for postpartum depression. The community social worker can collect additional information when making referrals to other organizations that serve new mothers, and social workers can use the screening to help the mother see her own growth and change with the intervention. And I think that's one thing that we don't do that well as social workers. We tend to shy away from these scales when, in point of fact, they do have utility. One of the areas where they can be useful is to help the mother see how she is making progress in her work. So the scales that are quite easy to use and have been normed on mothers of color include the Edinburgh Postnatal Depression Scale, the Center for Epidemiological Studies Depression Scale, Beck's Postpartum Depression Predictors Inventory, and the Postpartum Depression Screening Scale. Now, the Edinburgh is a 10-item scale, and as you can see, Carol and I have provided you with the HTML for each of these scales for you to reference. This 10-item scale asks the mothers to respond to each question with the answer that comes closest to how she's felt within the past 7 days, not just today. So it does take some history into account. The scale has been normed on mothers of color and has been self-administered and self-scored, so you don't have to have a psychologist right with you. The mother can sum up the score for herself. The scores range from 0 to 30, with a score of 10 indicating probable depression. And as a side note, some of the mothers we have interviewed have scores of upwards of 28. And again, a lot of these mothers do not like to self-identify as having depression, even though it's quite clear that the depression has set in. The Center for Epidemiological Studies scale is a good scale for social workers in perinatal clinics. It's developed specifically to identify depression in the general population. So ferreting out what questions may be more relevant to the postpartum mother is up to the worker, perhaps. It contains 20 items to assess symptoms experienced during the past week, again. Items are evaluated in alignment with the criteria for depression and the DSM, and as Carol had pointed out, that can be a little bit rocky, because if the mother herself isn't buying into the thinking of depression, or if it seems too medical model, this scale she may feel is tapping into something else, tapping into depression which she may not identify with. And a score of 10 or higher indicates depression, and again, here we provided the link for you. The Beck's Depression Postpartum Depression Predictors Inventory is a self-report questionnaire. It requires a health professional to administer. That's not to say you have to know a lot about psychometrics to administer the test. It's just they prefer to have someone who's a healthcare worker with you at the time that you administer it to help the mother understand what some of the questions are about and how to interpret the outcomes of the survey. Explores depression during pregnancy, the predictor variables, and after delivery predictor variables, and we provided those for you in an earlier slide, and includes a guide to questions for its use. So how you as the worker, when providing or administering the survey, how you, it kind of guides you along and how to ask the questions, and again, there's the HTML. And finally, the postpartum depression screening scale can be administered 2 weeks postpartum. It's a 35-item scale, so it takes about 5 to 10 minutes to administer, and does provide our overall severity score, asks the women to rate how they have been feeling over the past 2 weeks, so not just a one-week cutoff here, but 2 weeks, and has a very good specificity and sensitivity scores, and a positive predictive value of about 90%, meaning it does a pretty good job at hitting the bullseye when you're not quite sure if what you're dealing with here is depression. And it's designed to assess the present severity and type of symptoms, and again, the HTML.
One of the sets of standards in which we can couch some of this work comes from the National Association of Perinatal Social Workers, and they have a number of different sets of standards, but we looked at the standards for perinatal social workers working with patients experiencing postpartum depression. And so of significance, we are social workers. This association, of course, supports that women with previous histories of postpartum depression, other mood or anxiety disorders or risk factors should receive services from a social worker, including a full biopsychosocial assessment. Another standard addresses what are some of the educational pieces and supports and interventions that should be for the mother herself. Providing education and information to family members, partners, spouses, thinking about if they are seen in the postpartum, being screened and using a standardized assessment scale similar to the ones that we've described as what we have found to be the most useful and appropriate. Then the last one is how to be able to provide and support education to medical and support staff regarding the psychosocial aspects of postpartum depression, especially in healthcare settings for perinatal social workers. From our preliminary research so far, these are some of the things that the mothers are telling us that are helping. And in qualitative research, you do what's called a constant comparative method. So as you listen to the interviews, you transcribe them, you begin to analyze them, and you begin to identify themes, you begin to use those themes as you continue your interviewing, but you also can begin to apply those themes to practice right away. So when women talked about what was helping before, during, and after, for social work it comes back to the quality of relationship, that they wanted genuine, caring relationships with a provider, whether it was a physician, a nurse, a case manager, social worker, in which they could disclose and discuss their concerns about their life situation that were contributing to these feelings. And so they would say things like, I've seen my counselor, my therapist, tear up. She didn't just listen. She felt more what I was saying. I feel like she really cares. And she never closed me out. She said, I'm pushing for you. So there's always the concern, particularly with formal mental health, when clients do not keep their appointments on a regular basis, that the mental health setting is required to close that case. They're not able to continue with the formal service plan and the meeting of goals. But the very things that these women need to come and talk about are the things that make it hard for them to keep appointments. They don't have a daycare provider today. They have to bring a sick child home from school. Their car has broken down and they don't have transportation. There's a crisis with another member of their family. All those kinds of things can interfere with their ability to keep regular appointments. So not closing me out and keeping me as one of your patients, clients, so that I can continue to see you when I can get there is really important. They talked about having a flexible and open relationship with time to talk during the appointment. So you know how in medical settings patients feel rushed. They will have an appointment at 4, but they know their provider has to see someone else at 4:30, and they may not even start to tell you what's going on because they know there isn't enough time for you to hear or to listen. But appreciating that if they tell a provider that they're overwhelmed, that provider will continue to see them and to have appointments and to allow time to discuss the issues. even in doing our study, we had to use the language that the mothers use. So we had to ask them if they felt stressed, worried, anxious, sad, depressed, describe the symptoms. If we said, have you experienced postpartum depression, they would just look at us. If we were trying to identify people by just being in the waiting rooms and talking to possible participants. So we had to use their language. The things that they described were finding it important that providers listened, provided validation of their feelings, provided support for them for what they're doing, encouragement that they could take care of their children, they were good mothers, they could find solutions, recognizing their strengths, helping to empower them through problem solving, and helping them to access resources in order to improve their situations in the care of their children and families. They did perceive that formal mental health treatment was unhelpful. They were uncomfortable if they went to formal mental health treatment with treatment cohorts who appeared to be strangers to them, people who had more severe mental health problems than they had, and that were not struggling with things that they were struggling with as mothers in everyday situations. Most of them said medication was not helpful, medication would dull their feelings, make them not feel like they cared about anything. If they had a week-long hospitalization, one woman said, I just needed to get away from the issues I was going through, but there were too many crazy people in there, it just made things worse. And then again, what we said about trying to make the weekly appointments, one woman said, there's too much stuff going on in my life, making it impossible for me to get to all of the meetings. Eventually, I just gave up. That's exactly what we don't want to see happen as providers. Informal supports that women use themselves, certainly family who could provide any of these kinds of tasks. For some of the women, they needed more support from their families than what they were receiving. Resolving issues that they might have with the fathers of their children in order to get their help. Some women did have fathers who were supportive, not all of them did. Many of them used support from faith-based organizations, so attending church several times a week. They used prayer, support of their minister, might listen to Christian radio or listen to books, and really wanting to talk to other mothers who were going through the same things. The formal supports, wanting someone to talk to, which included other mothers, wanting a strong relationship with their care provider, someone that they could count on who was there on a regular basis, that have continuity with their care provider. They needed flexibility in appointments and scheduling. They wanted to be educated on what some of these feelings and symptoms were and when it should be of concern, when it's more than the usual. And education on the roles of other providers within the healthcare settings who they might be able to spend time with in order to get the support, the problem solving, et cetera, that they need, because it won't always be the medical provider who can go through all of those steps. So far in our work, although we're not espousing necessarily the DSM-IV criteria as the absolute path to trying to understand mothers like this, we do feel that there does need to be a typology, and what we've been working with is asking mothers about these feelings, stress, worry, anxiety, depression, and trying to distinguish. Do you feel these things rarely or never, occasionally, noticeably, so that they can say, yeah, this is disturbing, it gets in the way of my functioning, or where they're having symptoms so severely that it really is interfering with their functioning and where we might consider it a disorder.
So the recommendations, relationship, relationship, relationship. The relationship building is key. The clients we're interviewing, the women we're interviewing are telling us that relationship is the most important thing. Without the relationship, we can't do anything. I'm preaching to the choir here. I realize we all know that, but this has very much been reinforced by the mothers that we're seeing. So our recommendations for educators include course content on diverse experiences and postpartum feelings mothers have, stress the vital importance of the client relationship, and acknowledge some systems issues, the challenges in keeping office appointments, transportation, childcare, and the invalidation from family members. Many of the mothers themselves did tell us that they really don't have anyone to whom they can turn, or the people to whom they would turn, sisters, mothers, are likewise very burdened with other problems that they're addressing. Build additional content on screening instruments that public health social workers use. If the mothers aren't coming forward to tell us about their feelings and their experiences, we need a way to be able to get in there to assess and potentially diagnose. We need to include course content on the use of screening instruments and field educators to work with students on how to administer those instruments and provide in-service trainings to community social workers on how to use them. We have references for you, and again, we're Robert Keefe and Carol Brownstein-Evans. Thank you very much.